Web 2.0.
Innovation.
Trends.
Collaboration.
Software.
Metadata.
Got the world turning as fast as it can? Hear how technology can help. Legally speaking, with two of the top legal technology experts, authors, and lawyers, Dennis Kennedy and Tom Mile. Welcome to the Kennedy Mile Report here on the Legal Talk Network.
And welcome to episode 305 of the Kennedy Mile Report. I'm Dennis Kennedy in Ann Arbor.
And I'm Tom Mile in Dallas.
In our last episode, we continued our annual tradition of sharing our New Year's tech resolutions. Have you made your 2022 tech resolutions? If not, give that episode a listen. In this episode, we wanted to discuss the relatively new phenomenon of legal tech and innovation labs and programs in law schools, a topic of special interest to me. Where are we and where might we be going? Tom, what's all on our agenda for this episode?
Well, Dennis, in this edition of the Kennedy Mile Report, we will indeed be talking about law school labs and what they might mean for legal education, legal profession, and access to justice. In our second segment, we'll talk about our good friend, Wendy Werner, and what she taught us about personalizing your approach to technology, among many other things. We will miss her very much. And as usual, we'll finish up with our parting shots, that one tip, website, or observation that you can start to use the second that this podcast is over. But first up, law school labs. We talk every now and again on the podcast about innovation, and Dennis, of course, is doing a lot of work in that area, but we don't spend a lot of time talking about where so much of that innovation is occurring. You'd hope that lawyers, having the benefit of being out in the world and getting experience, would be leading the way in innovation. And it's true that many law firms, mostly large law firms, have innovation centers. But where I think it's really happening and where it's really interesting is in the law schools. A lot of forward-thinking law schools have created laboratories, maybe not just called laboratories, but they've created areas where they're working on real-world problems, developing interesting technology, interesting solutions to access to justice and other legal issues. With Dennis being someone who leads one of these labs, we thought we would devote some time to explaining what these labs do, how they're impacting the practice of law, maybe some other stuff. Dennis, you know that I'm going to ask you to set the stage and give us some definitions. So do you want to get us started?
Yep. So this phenomenon started happening a while back, and you could see it, I think, coming out of Chicago Kent Law School with Ron Stout, Suffolk with Mark Lortzen, and other people were sort of nibbling at the edges of this, and then it sort of grew into more of a structured approach in a number of law schools. So you can look at Codex at Stanford. You can look at, where I'm at, Center for Law Technology and Innovation at Michigan State, which, had other names before, Suffolk Law School, Northwestern with Dan Lina, Chicago Kent, just a number of these programs that are out there. And usually what defines them, I think, is there is a structure, an academic structure around it. So something like a center or a lab notion, and a group of students, professors, sometimes might be multidisciplinary, and usually some involvement with the legal community, with an idea of either a research or an experimental type of focus. And we're seeing more of that and more attention to it. I'd say probably in the last year, one of the most interesting things is somebody who I really admire, April Dawson, who's at North Carolina Central, which is one of the historic black universities. The law school there got a $5 million grant from Intel to create a lab. So there's a lot of things going on. And it's, and typically they're going to have a focus of one kind or another. So it could be on data analytics. Stanford does some great stuff on user experience. There's access to justice. You see some other things out there. University of Richmond, I would say, and Duke are other examples. So you could find a good number. I would say there's probably, my sense is maybe 25 or 30 of, let's call it the, I guess there's about 200 law schools in the U.S., give or take. And then there are some interesting things happening around the world, in Europe and in Asia. So that's sort of a broad overview, Tom. It probably makes sense for you just to kind of ask some clarifying questions from your point of view to kind of pin me down on a few details.
Well, see, what's funny is your statement that your sense is there are 25 labs out there, because that sounds like there's not a great deal of certainty. I'll get back to that in a second about that. But here's what I want to do first is what do you define as a lab? And the reason why I ask that is, in doing my research, I found probably 25 different things out there, and they all are grouped under a loose category of labs, but they don't call themselves labs all. Some of them will say that they're clinics. Some of them are LLM programs, which I'm not sure an LLM program is really a lab. Lab sounds less, more time constrained or time limited than an LLM program is. Some call it a lab when they partner with vendors just to try out legal technology. There's an innovation law center. There are institutes. Are these all labs, or how would you distinguish if we're distinguishing?
Well, I think that gets into the old definitional debate that I always like to avoid. But I think there is a notion of centers or institutes, which I'd say this sort of academic structure around it that, you know, may involve fundraising, may involve interdisciplinary efforts, and what would probably have let's just call it a center in my example, because that's the one I'm most familiar with, where you could say, well, there could be the center, which has its own director or somebody running it, and then one or more professors associated with it who kind of set direction. And then what happens there will reflect the interests of the law school, either in innovation, data analytics, as in Chicago Kent, and or other kind of focus areas out there. And you'll see that. And then I think some engagement with the typically the local community. And you see that like at University of Richmond. You also see it at Suffolk. I also think you see some of that at Penn State. So there are some examples of that. So that's the most structured. Then I think you're right. There are some things where you say we can do something that's a focus area, and it may have a number of things associated with it that we're looking at technology that's could be training, could be practical skills, could be a cluster of classes. And then I think there also is, although this is the most difficult thing, I think, as a practical matter to pull off and sustain, is something that is like a lab, where we say in partnership, typically like with courts, vendors, other people, we're actually really digging in and doing some research. And that's some of the things you see with data analytics, maybe a little bit with AI, and definitely some things in access to justice. So it's like, what can we do together in that area? And then also partnering, you know, across the university is typically what you see in the lab. So with the labs, you do get a sense of given projects that you're working on. See, the difference between a lab and what I would see as a clinic, it's a clinic to me are doing, you know, actual representation and work for clients of one type or another, whereas a lab is doing what I would say is would be considered more a general or academic type of research.
So no labs out there who are trying experiments out on clients in real time?
Well, I think that that's an interesting to, you know, how you think of as you ask that question. So I'd say I look at what they're doing at Suffolk, where they've created these access to justice applications and rolled them out really quickly, you know, in connection with the pandemic and evictions and other things like that. And I would say they're productizing, but I don't think they're actually representing.
But they're not representing people when they do
clients.
That. No.
Yeah. And I would think that you could do, the lab could do something in connection with the clinic. So say you had a clinic that was, say, doing expungements or, you know, a certain focus, that, and then the lab could take some of the data that was generated through the clinical representation and work with it and suggest improvements, look at process, those sorts of things. So that's a way I would, you know, I would kind of separate the two, but I think there's a lot of different approaches. And so I think it is a little bit hard to say, oh, this fits the definition and this one doesn't, because I think we're still early on in the defining stage. And I don't think it makes sense to say, you know, it sort of reminds me of time back in the early days of blogging where people say, like, well, even though you have this thing that looks like a blog, because it doesn't have this factor, it's not really a blog and you're not a blogger. And you go like, yeah, fine, who cares? We're getting something done.
So let's clarify it further. Let me see if I can narrow it down further. In your mind, are labs, quote labs, are they all about or have a technology component? Because I know that I saw several that don't. They call themselves labs, but they are working on, you know, civil rights issues, and it's about finding innovative ways to deal with legal matters, not necessarily involving technology. So is everything you just talked about seems to have a technological component to it, that there's technology and people are finding ways to use technology, but it seems like that the use of the term lab seems to be more freely used to mean anything to indicate an experiment to improve the practice of law.
Yeah, so the way that the Michigan State Center for Law, Technology, and Innovation sort of structurally set up is there's something called Legal R&D Lab, something called the Innovation Hub, and something called the Emerging Technology Research Node. And we're still in the process of building out, and that's sort of like a more aspirational structure than an existing structure right now. But I think those are sort of the things where there's something that's kind of hands-on, actual experimentation type of lab. The Innovation Hub, which would be a collaboration and look at different ways that we can innovate in the area of law. So I see it more as a collaboration hub. And then the Emerging Technology Research Node, as it's called, would be, say, there's an academic focus on the impact of new technologies on law in various ways. And in those cases, you say somebody could do a focus, I would call it, on say you're interested in virtual reality and other things like that. And that could become part of like a lab that's devoted to new approaches to, you know, trial presentation and things like that. So I think you're typically looking for this flexibility, and it's going to vary with both the interests of the faculty and the students. And probably, you know, as time goes on, once you get funding, that will have an influence on the direction as well.
So that kind of leads me to my next question, which is stability of the labs. When I was kind of doing my research and I was looking out there for the different programs that are available, a lot of programs, maybe I should not say a lot, but several programs that were listed as going even as late as 2 years ago, when I try to find them, they're nowhere to be seen. Or they've let, you know, there were a couple of them where their websites showed the last activity was 4 years ago. It seems like that not everything is destined to survive when you start at a law school. What are the things that you need to take into account for the success of a lab program?
Well, there is the COVID factor, of course, on some of this stuff. But I think that there is, there's funding, there's commitment, and there's definitely, you know, having the individuals there or the groups there that carry it through, and then the support and the vision that come from the school itself, where they say, this is something we want to do to distinguish ourselves. And That's why I like to use, you know, April Dawson and North Carolina Central, is that the, you know, if you have a $5 million grant, that's the sort of thing where you can say, we have a lot of, they're going to do some cool things, I think, as a result of that, it's likely to have longevity. I think where you have some professors doing stuff on a part-time basis, you know, where they find some time that reflects their interests, and they have a group of students who do that, it's a little harder to sustain. And then, you know, as the students roll through, you might have a group that's, you know, very interested in what the original focus of the lab was, or, and the next groups have less interest in that. And you're trying to gauge that. So right now, as I look to what's, even in designing classes for the future, I know there are some things that students are going to be interested in because I'm surveying them, I'm talking to them. And, you know, some of them aren't going to be surprises, you know, like Web3, everything involving sports, gaming. I mean, there's tons of stuff out there that are going to attract the interest of students. Whether that becomes, and then you're trying to take that interest and align it with the overall mission of the law school and the university, which I think, and if you get all that stuff lined up and the right people, the longevity will happen. I think as it's a part-time thing and there's turnover and other things like that, it is hard to sustain.
Okay, so maybe this is a super broad question, but let's expand beyond. You've talked a little bit about Michigan State. You talked a little bit about Suffolk. What are the kinds of things that these labs work on? I mean, what are the? There's probably a broad range, but in general, what are they working on? Is it all access to justice? Is it more than that? What are the things that we're seeing mostly?
Well, I think you're seeing a broad range. I think there's a lot of cool stuff happening in access to justice, and it kind of runs a range. So you can say, you know, Dan Katz at Chicago Kent has really been involved in data analytics, artificial intelligence, those sorts of things. So real strong focus there. Dan Lynn at Northwestern, is doing this really cool program that works with what I would call the computer science department and the law school. And it's kind of like hard technology skills. So you see that on one side, at University of Richmond, they're doing some stuff where they're actually, reaching out to law firms and helping them with, management, process improvement. Nicole Morris at Emory is doing this great thing with technology transfer, where the clinic, where the center, which is called Tiger there, actually helps get the technologies that have been developed at the university out. That's a cool approach. Arizona State is doing some stuff in the access to justice. Stanford's doing a lot of both hard tech, and then Margaret Hagan is doing this really cool, human-centered design stuff. Vanderbilt, another place where they're looking at, access to justice, design, and improving delivery of legal services, among other things. So there is a lot happening out there. At BYU, definitely some productization in the access to justice space. So there are a lot of different approaches, and it's almost what I like about it is it's just like a really creative area within the law school world. And so, you see that, and then as I mentioned a little bit, some of the stuff going on in the rest of the world is also very cool as well.
You know, what's interesting to me is, I think having law school labs is a great idea. I think that that innovation needs to be happening in two areas. It needs to happen in law firms, which unfortunately means they're really big firms because they're the only ones who can afford to do it. And in the law schools, because we need to be training our future lawyers to be more than just lawyers. They need to be working on solutions for the future because they are the future. That's corny, but I'll say it that way. So I like that. But what I don't get a sense of is, and what I'm wondering if there's a benefit here is, it seems like when you say, I have a sense that there's 25 programs out there, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of collaboration between the organizations. And maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm missing it, maybe there's something you haven't mentioned yet, but it feels like, you know, why isn't there a law school labs conference every year where everybody gets together and talks about it? And I know that there are some conferences that get together and talk about those things, but I don't get the sense that it is, everybody helping to pool their collective knowledge or helping each other to be better. Am I wrong about that? Or is that something that's actually going on?
Well, you're sort of right and you're sort of wrong. And so what I would say is, like, last summer, I believe it was, there was a great webinar with a lot of discussions with the people who were doing the legal labs, which actually was the reason this became a topic for the podcast that I put on the list. And there was this feeling at the end of that webinar that we were all going to get together and maybe we should have a conference and we should have regular meetings and all of that and define, like, who all fit the category and invite more people into it and see what we could do. That, to this point, hasn't happened because there's this little thing called COVID and other things that really do have an impact on moving those things forward. I have one of my RAs working on coming up with a list of all the programs. There's a good list that needs to be updated that I've seen. So I think we're at this sort of baby step phase, but I think that collaboration is going to happen. It's needs to be coordinated, and Tom, we did a whole podcast on how do you start legal tech communities. It's some of the same issues on there, but I'm generally optimistic that over time, and I think through the American Association of Law Schools, that's where we're likely to see that happen.
Well, as someone who has co-authored a book with someone else on collaboration, I would say there's no better time to collaborate on things than when you're all stuck at home and doing stuff together. But that's just me. So let's look at the future. Where are we headed? What are the things that we need to be looking for? And how can people learn more about law school labs?
Well, I think the first place to go is to go to your alma mater and say, like, hey, what's actually happening at my old law school, are there some interesting things there that I didn't know about? And then I think you're starting to look at the usual suspects, I would say, just kind of get an idea of what's out there. And I've mentioned a bunch of schools, and Tom, you looked through and you found about 25 places. There's their websites, other ways to find things, and then they're just so kind of it's going to be self-education. And then everybody who's working in one of these loves to talk about it and wants to share what they're doing. We're also seeing alumni come out of these programs as well. And so we're still at a point where you have to go out and kind of find it. But, I would say within, a year or two, you're going to see more structure to be able to find that and the collaboration there. So I think you're right. There is no better time to collaborate, but it's also a volunteer group. And as we all know, that if you make suggestions in a volunteer group, people usually think that you're volunteering, which causes some hesitation on the part of people. So that can be an issue as well.
And so I assume, and this is a loaded, maybe softballish question for you, that you are bullish on law school labs moving forward.
Yeah, I'm bullish. And the one thing that I think that COVID actually makes me bullish on this, because I think we have to try different things. I think that the lab phenomenon is a great way for the law schools to reach out into and connect with the community. It could be local, could be alumni, but sort of where their university, the community their university lives in. And that's what's really interesting to me. I think they become a potential like R&D department for, you know, state and federal courts, for, you know, for law departments, other things like that. So I think that community piece is what I'm really bullish on. To the extent that I have hesitation, I think that, you know, it is different. I think that there is, you know, definitely, you know, people are looking at the traditional legal education approach. And so that will have, that will be the friction that needs to be overcome. And that's difficult to predict how that's going to play out. And it could be that, you know, it may turn out that, as you said, that it could be in large law firms, other organizations, that you see that this type of center or lab might work better than in the university structure. But we'll see how that plays out. But I think it's a way for the whole legal ecosystem to start to work together to achieve some positive results.
Well, let's make sure to revisit this in an upcoming episode, see how things have gone a few months or years down the road. All right, before we move on to our next segment, let's take a quick break for a message from our sponsors.
Join us at LegalUp on April 24th and 25th, hosted by InfoTrack. This fun and free virtual event will help you propel your legal career to its next phase. There's something for attorneys, paralegals, and for practice leaders. Join InfoTrack and One Legal on April 24th and 25th. Don't miss out on your chance to register. InfoTrack.com/LegalUp and get inspired. Filing court documents, serving legal papers, collecting electronic signatures, all critical parts of the litigation process, yet ones that are time-consuming and error-prone. But what if you could do more straight from your case or document management software? InfoTrack automates data entry, document selection, tracking, and information syncing across all these core tasks and more by integrating with your core systems like Clio, Smokeball, Leap, MyCase, and others. Spend more time on substantive legal work and less time on busy work. Learn how simple it can be at InfoTrack.com/simple.
And now let's get back to the Kennedy Mile Report. I'm Tom Mile.
And I'm Dennis Kennedy. Tom, as you mentioned, we lost a very close friend, Wendy Werner, recently. And it's been difficult for me because I knew Wendy for a very long time. We wanted to remember Wendy and pay a little tribute to her. And I thought it might be good to talk to her, talk about her as an example of a person who never really felt she was a tech person at all, sometimes was aggressively non-tech, and she might even use that phrase. She took a certain pride in saying that she was the last person using a flip phone, but her own approach to technology adoption was actually really thoughtful, and I think we could all learn from it. I know that she talked to people she thought for years before she went and bought an iPad, and then she loved it. And you know, once she got one, I think her in her own way, she illustrated what I think of when I talk about jobs to be done and knowing what you're hiring your technology to do for you. So, Tom, I'll let you lead this segment off.
So you knew Wendy longer than I did. So I think you're going to have a better or a different approach to it than I did to her and technology. But I want to do a very quick background on Wendy for those listeners who didn't know her. Wendy wasn't a lawyer. She worked a lot with lawyers and the law. She was a career coach for lawyers. She was the founding board member of Arch City Defenders, which was a St. Louis criminal justice reform and relief agency. I got to know her through her many years of service in the ABA's law practice division. She was, I think, responsible in a big way for us writing this latest version of our collaboration tools book. She was a great photographer. She was a great lover of Aussie Shepherd rescue dogs. She loved the Oregon coast and in turn made me love it as well. But this is a technology podcast, so we want to remember Wendy's relationship with technology. Wendy is of a generation where you wouldn't be surprised to see her ignorant and uncaring about technology. I think in today's language, she was definitely a digital immigrant when we talk about technology. But she didn't hate technology. She didn't love it, but she didn't hate it. I coined the term, after being with her for a while, I coined the term technology ambivalent to describe her, and she loved that term. She mentioned it several times to me, but she really could take it or leave it. And I think what is interesting is that when she decided to take it, she was very intentional about doing that. As Dennis mentioned, it took her a while to commit to just getting an iPad. She learned how to use that device, and when she used it for, and she used it for the purposes for which she needed it, and rarely more. And she was completely comfortable with that. As Dennis said, I think this is a refreshing approach to technology, to get what you need out of it and be completely satisfied with what you get. We could all, I think, do with a little tech ambivalence from time to time. Wendy, we will miss you so very much. Dennis, do you want to take it from here?
Yeah. So, I mean, you summed things up. I mean, I got to know Wendy when she was, headed up the career services office at St. Louis U. And I work with her on a St. Louis minority clerkship program and knew her for many years. And considered a very close friend, but I it just struck me, as we were thinking about her, is that she just really interrogated technology in a way that I liked. She was more conservative about it, but she was like the opposite. And I was thinking before we did the show, I sometimes think of people who will say, oh, I have these 10 new gadgets I got, and I'm trying this and I'm trying that. And I want to say to them, like, well, what about the last shiny new thing that you were saying was the best thing ever? Wendy was kind of the opposite of that. And I think you could learn from that. So in her photography, she totally understood, like, what equipment she needed and why. But with just saying, and to have tech for tech's sake, and especially computers, that was a different story. And so I think the iPhone or the iPad thing for her was to see her take to that, because there were a number of us who told her for a long time, she would say, here's what I don't like, and here's what I don't need, and this would help me, and that would help me. And I think I remember, I know I said a lot, and I know you said Tom a lot, Jim Calloway, others would say, like, you're talking iPad, Wendy, you're just talking iPad. And then once she tried to understand it first, and then worked with it, and she was really, really good at using the iPad. I learned things from that. And so I think that sometimes when you it's good to be conservative in your approach. You don't have to go to the newest thing and try to say I'm going to be first at this. But if you can understand why you're going to use it, what the job to be done is. And she just illustrated that whole jobs to be done notion of one of my best friends the whole time I was in St. Louis. I'll miss her greatly, but just a life well lived in so many ways. Now it's time for parting shots. That one tip, website, or observation you can use the second this podcast ends. Tom, take it away.
So mine is a website. This is called 12feet.io. It's just 12ft.io. I'll put the link in the show notes. The tagline there is, show me a 10-foot paywall and I'll show you a 12-foot ladder. And this operates from the theory that any website that has a paywall to it, they're still going to let Google index it because they want those articles. They want that content to show up in the search results. And so that version of a document still exists somewhere in a Google cache. And so what 12foot does is you put in a URL of a paywalled article, and it will go and find the cached unpaywalled version of the page. Now, it's not perfect. I can't get it to work on Wall Street Journal articles. It's hard to get it to work on New York Times articles, but there are a lot of websites that I was able to find the unpaywalled version of it. So if you're looking for something that has a paywall, if some site that you have no intention of subscribing to that just to get to that one article, then put the URL into 12foot.io and you might get the unpaywall version for free.
I'm sure publishers will be happy with that one, but I think you're right, Tom. This paywall stuff has made the internet really difficult to use in the past year. So I'm in favor of anybody who's helping us open up access to information. So my parting shots, and I have two of them, Tom. So quick one is the 2022 ABA Legal Technology Resource Center's Women of Legal Tech honoree nominations are now open, and I will ask Tom to put the URL into the show notes, so you can find the place to submit your nominees for consideration. It's a great list, a great project, and there are great people on the list. And if you know women of legal tech that deserve to be on the list, then by all means nominate them. The second thing is very new for me that I'm experimenting with. So I did my personal quarterly offsite, and one of my things was I'm calling the smalls list. And so what I found is it could be technology annoyances, it could be other things that are just kind of small projects that kind of get in your way. So sometimes you have low energy, or you just have a little bit of time, and you're thinking like, oh, I need to set something up, or I need to do something, and it's going to take a short period of time. I'm just creating a list of those smalls. So when I find myself in that situation, I go, oh, I can do these things, and I can start to knock those things off. And I think there's these little improvements I can make to my life. Like I just did something today that had been sitting around for a long time that I knocked out in about 15 minutes, and I feel great about it. And so you get the sense of accomplishing things and, you know, getting stuff off of your to-do list and out of your head and done. And I just call it smalls. And so, if you look around and say, here are some little things that I like to do, and start to put them on a list and just knock them off, I think it's going to make you feel a lot better.
There was actually an article in somewhere that I saw today that talked about the whole notion of productivity around any task that you can get done in 2 minutes or less, go ahead and do it. And she was writing about how much more productive it made her feel. So a very good tip.
Well, I would say the 2-minute rule is like a great David Allen thing. And what I always found with it was that the problem came up when you thought something was a 2-minute task, and it really ended up being like a 2-hour task.
You need to have good judgment about it, and hopefully, as you practice on it, you get better at
estimating. I'll just take 2 minutes to put this IKEA piece of furniture together, and then next thing you know, it's 4 hours later.
That's clearly not a 2-minute task. And that wraps it up for this edition of the Kennedy Mile Report. Thanks for joining us on the podcast. You can find show notes for the show on the Legal Talk Network's page for this podcast. If you like what you hear, please subscribe to the show in iTunes or on the Legal Talk Network site, where you can find archives of all of our previous episodes along with transcripts. If you'd like to get in touch with us, reach out to us on LinkedIn or Twitter, or remember, you can always leave us a voicemail at 720-441-6822. So until the next podcast, I'm Tom Mile.
And I'm Dennis Kennedy, and you've been listening to the Kennedy Mile Report, a podcast on legal technology with an internet focus. If you like what you heard today, please rate us in Apple Podcasts, and we'll see you next time for another episode of the Kennedy Mile Report on the Legal Talk Network.
Thanks for listening to the Kennedy Mile Report. Check out Dennis and Tom's book, The Lawyer's Guide to Collaboration Tools and Technologies, Smart Ways to Work Together, from ABA Books or Amazon. And join us every other week for another edition of the Kennedy Mile Report, only on the Legal Talk Network.